When God created the earth 6,000 years ago, he filled it with the most fantastic wildlife. The world we live in is full of incredible diversity. Some animals are noble, reflecting the best of humanity. Some are literally evil. The incredible technology of podcasting has allowed us to bring you closer to animals than we ever have before. In this series, we will explore the darkest corners and highest mountains of our world and meet some of its most remarkable creatures. From the lowly frog, to the beautiful song of the siren.
Today is gonna be the day that they're gonna throw it back to you. By now, should it somehow realize.
And the mother pelican who pecks her children to death.
Fucking kids, man.
Caca.
This is medieval planet Earth.
Now brimming wine in lordly cup is he who shine before each eager guest. And silence fills the crowded hall, as deep as when the herald's call thrills in the loyal breast.
Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron, a bit of an odd duck. That's right, today we're doing animals.
I actually, before we get into the animals, I have an announcement to make, and I haven't cleared this with Olivia, but I think, you know, I think it's important to be honest with our listeners.
Is this what the pilot on the 9/11 plane felt like when they started hijacking?
Olivia, this is serious. Okay. No jokes. I've come into the possession of a piece of information that I think is important for our listeners to be aware of. And to be honest, I've sat on this information for far too long. I should have told people about this months ago. And, you know, that's on me. But anyway, the point is, what I have to say is this. Spring is just around the corner.
Yeah, boy! Welcome back to the podcast. It's a beautiful sunny day.
It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
Yes, so it is. And all of the creatures are coming out from their hibernation. The birds are flying north, which I think they do in the summer. And, yeah, it's time for us to talk about nature and animals in the Middle Ages.
I am so excited about it. I'm a flower child, so I just want to talk about my animal friends.
Well, my friends, the animals. Some of them are animal foes.
No. And specifically, we're going to be talking about what medieval people thought and wrote about animals. Real animals, fake animals, all kinds of animals.
And we're going to be focusing in particular on one specific type of medieval text, the bestiary, or bestiary, am I allowed to say that? So basically a big medieval animal compendium, a who's who of the animal kingdom.
Like the big animal dictionaries that I had as a child.
That had all the illustrations in
it. Yes!
God, those were so good.
Be like, this is a cheetah, it can run very fast.
Yes! And six-year-old me would be like, that's
hell
so
yeah.
Cool. I wish that were me.
That's why Animorphs was so popular.
Yes.
Because it's like, wow, that's literally me.
I loved Animorphs.
And now I'm a rhino. Can we talk about Animorphs for 30 seconds?
Yeah, okay.
Look, I obviously am aware that, like, body horror is a very important part of the Animorphs universe.
Yeah.
But, like, just putting that aside for a second, those were super dark books.
He got trapped as a hawk.
He got turned, his brain turned into, there was a, okay.
Or was for those he a who falcon?
For those who don't know, it was a hawk. For those who don't know, there's an American children's book series called Animorphs about teenagers whose superpower was they could turn into animals, except it had all this really bizarre, dark lore. And there was, like, alien slugs that took over their parents' brains, and there was, like, dismemberment and horrible death. And the covers, which you've probably seen, are, like, of a woman turning into a starfish.
Yeah, but like all of the stages.
Yes, all the intermediate stages.
And it's not just about how it's their superpower, it's about how it's their superpower because it was bestowed upon
by
them.
By a four-legged blue alien
who
with
is dying.
Eyes. Yes.
Whose spaceship?
My spaceship is dying.
Whose spaceship crashed on Earth? And yeah, it's not great. Well, the books are actually amazing. I loved them. Whenever I went past them in the library, they were like forbidden fruit. They looked so weird and scary until eventually I plucked the apple.
You plucked up the courage to be like, I could read a book about a woman who turns into a bee.
Yep. No, exactly.
No, I was sort of grimly fascinated by Animorphs, but my main animal interest was always the David Attenborough shows, the Planet Earth shows, which you haven't seen.
No, I was warrior cats. Pure warrior cats.
Yeah, just fantasy instead of real educational content.
Yeah, well, all those Planet Earth shows are CGI.
On Gentleman's of Roland.
So, what is a bestiary when it's at home? Well, to understand that, we have to go back to the very first bestiary. It was a book called Physiologus, written by a man called Mr. Beast. No, that's not true. It's a Greek text written in the second century, but possibly as far forward as the fourth. This is how wonderful dating is in the late antique, early medieval period. Was a window of 300 years when it could have been written. Anyway, it was sort of this compendium of all the creatures of the earth that brought together both animals that we know to be real and then mythological creatures and sort of just sort of mixed them all together. They're like, here's a centaur and here's a hedgehog. And there's no sense of differentiation between them, which I find quite fun.
Yeah.
It's like, it is as plausible that you would meet a centaur as you would a hedgehog.
Well, because a lot of the animals that are in the Physiologus and in bestiaries are also animals which are real, but which we can safely assume the author had never seen in person because they're so inaccurately described. So, for instance, hippos, rhinoceroses, crocodiles, and so... To me, I think a lot of these creatures, like centaurs, probably just, you know, it was probably just easy to assume, well, they're out there. I just haven't seen them. Because imagine trying to describe a rhino to someone.
No, it's like, I mean, the way that I think about it is that, like, yes, okay, when you think about satyrs or centaurs, you think, well, obviously there's not, like, a type of person that's also kind of an animal. But also, there is an entire continent full of guys that are, like, hairier people with weird faces and longer arms.
Yeah.
Those are real.
Yes.
And you would have known about them. So, like, why wouldn't there be people with goat legs?
Exactly.
Especially if you don't have the sort of logic of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we'll get into very shortly into some of those animals. But I think it's very important to do a little bit of scene setting about what medieval people thought about when they thought about animals. Because one of the interesting things about the Physiologus is the taxonomy, or rather, the lack thereof. For a long time, there was no clear sense of organization that anyone could sort of parse. To understand the taxonomy of the Physiologus, which inspires a whole bunch of books after it, we have to think, first of all, about what medieval people thought about when they thought about animals.
The Physiologus wasn't the only text about natural history that was influential from the start of the Middle Ages. So in, I believe, the 7th century, Isidor of Seville,
mm-hmm.
Is considered to be the last great scholar of antiquity, wrote a book called The Etymologies. The work itself is called Etymologies. It's not all about etymology. It's a compendium of classical sources that Isidore had his hands on and wanted to preserve at a time when everything was falling apart, kingdoms were disintegrating, the power vacuum was starting to form, and Isidore, being a bishop and more of an indoor person, didn't pick up his sword but his pen and copied down all of these sources. He didn't add much new material himself. he categorized them into 20 books that cover everything from the heavens to medicine to arts and sciences. He talks about string beans and about angels and about the spheres of the cosmos and different names for different types of women's clothing. And he also talks about animals quite a bit, and he draws on the Physiologus, on works by Pliny the Elder and Aristotle as well. And he incorporates not just Christian, but also a lot of, quote, pagan philosophy into this. So he's, you know, doesn't hesitate to say, well, we know this because Aristotle said it or because Pliny said it. And he does have an entire section about animals and about the natural world as well. And the Etymologies was, I would say, the definitive text of the Middle Ages. I mean, it was treated as kind of all you needed to know about everything and anything about the world. And actually, its influence was so great that a lot of the sources that Isidore drew on were themselves lost because they had been preserved in part in the Etymologies, and so people stopped caring about the full thing. They thought Isidore wrote down all we need to
know. It's sort of a medieval version of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, as in the fictional book within the book.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, one of the central themes and the reason why it's called the Etymologies, and we will return to this a bit later as well, is because Isidore has this idea that you can understand a word's true sense, which in Greek is its etymos, hence the word etymology. So it's the study of the true senses of things. And so we can understand the true sense of a word by understanding where that word came from. And so with regards to animals in the natural worlds, he discusses their names, where their names came from, and links that back to the true nature of the animals as he perceives it. So there's this idea from the onset that animals and the natural worlds, just like everything else in God's creation, has a true sense, and that is something that can be understood by people and has been, perhaps even you could say, created to benefit people. It's worth mentioning that Isidore is not following what could be described as a kind of, you know, legitimate linguistic approach with his etymologies. So some of them he gets right purely just kind of, you know, because a lot of words are related. So he'll say things like, the word company comes from the word companion. And it's like, you know, good job, Isidore. Or something like that. You know, he'll say quickly comes from the word quick because it's
damn,
when you
really
move quick. But then there's a lot of other things that he basically invents where you have to wonder for some of them if he even thought they were true. One of my favorite ones is that he derives the word for walking stick, which in Latin is baculum, from the name of the god Bacchus. And his explanation for this is that Bacchus is the god of wine. After you have a few, you'll need a walking stick to get home. So it's stuff, you know, in that kind of vein. He says that cats are called cats because they catch mice.
Wait, no, surely not.
No, I'm not saying it's true. It's just what he says.
No, that's what I'm that's what I'm amazed by.
Oh yeah. And similar things like that.
I think that is interesting about the etymologies is the sense to which he is sort of, he's using language to get at the true nature of things. And I think that this is emblematic of a tendency that you see throughout texts written about animals in the Middle Ages, which is to treat the animals themselves as sort of signs, as things which can be interpreted as part of like a wider, as instruments of the cosmos.
They're kind of like atomic almost, because, you know, there's not really a sense that they grow or change.
No.
They're just like atomic sort of moral principles encapsulated in flesh and blood.
And that, I think, actually brings us onto a really important point, which is medieval people did not see animals as, did not see humans as animals. The thing about humans is that we are both material and divine. Whereas, you know, the angels and all the sort of creatures of the heavens are fully divine, and animals are fully material.
We have our thumbs in a lot of pies.
We got a lot of stuff going on. and that's sort of the agony, isn't it, of being human. Is
yeah.
That you are both sort of called to a higher purpose, but you have base material impulses. And this actually helps has helped historians to finally get to grips with the structure of the Physiologus. Because, again, if you take a step back and try and understand it from, like, any kind of modern scientific taxonomological perspective, it's nonsense, you know. But if you look at each one of the entries in the book, each animal has its own entry where it has its name and a description of its character. And each description will contain within it a moral judgment about the nature of that animal.
Well, we've got that crocodiles shed tears because they are like people who confess sin but then sin again. So they're performing remorse.
Yeah, and you don't want to be like the crocodile.
And you don't, and because of that, you do not want to be like the crocodile.
Yeah, and so the point of once you understand it not from a scientific point of view, but from a narrative point of view, you can understand that the Physiologus is structured to make an argument about how a good Christian should behave. It's more, it is a mixture of natural history and moral instruction and theology all blended together.
And a healthy dash of folklore as well, yes. I would say, because there are all sorts of things that can't necessarily be given a purely, you know, a moral... can't be fully ascribed a purely moral purpose. I think the crocodile is a good example of this as well, because if you look in a bestiary, for instance, in the Cambridge Bestiary, which I was reading a translation of earlier, it will tell you that the crocodile is called crocodile because, or in Latin, it's cocodrillus, which comes from, or is
sounds
related
like
to...
Sounds like the name of a model.
It does, yeah.
I'm cocodrillus, and this is my new summer collection.
Exactly. But in Latin, this is related to the word for crocus, so saffron, and we're told that it's because crocodiles are yellow. And this
This is,
you know, something that's been carried on from antiquity, which, of course, as we know, crocodiles are... Well, they're brownish yellow. They've got some yellow in there.
They're green. They're green-gray.
Anyways, so we've got, you know...
You need a second pair of glasses on top of your existing pair of glasses.
I don't know where they were getting
hey,
this
Siri,
information from.
What color is a crocodile? Their colors range from brown to gray or greenish-brown. Spot what's missing there.
Look, tell it to the Romans, not me. And then we have the idea that crocodiles cry, which, as we know, or as you might know, is actually true. Crocodiles do weep, in a sense. They're not actually crying, of course, as people understand it, but we do have some facts about animals and some content that comes from direct observation of these animals. But then we're also throwing in a heavy layer of Christian theology by saying, well, the reason why they cry is because they're sinful in a specifically Christian moral way.
It really is. This is not the first time we've made this comparison on the show, but it really is a very sort of Rudyard Kipling just so stories kind of approach to animals.
Yeah.
It's like, how did the elephant get his trunk? Because he fucked up.
Exactly. Because he was a bastard. Why did the leopard get its spots? Adultery.
Where is his girl who dies on the field?
Let's talk about some animal facts. Medieval animal facts.
Okay.
So, Olivia has very kindly compiled a list of some of her favorite animals. We're going to go through a list of them and find out what medieval people thought about them.
Yeah, so we're going to kind of give you a interactive, not interactive actually, you can't interact with us. We're going to give you an...
Not even if you see us in the street.
Do not message us, do not approach us. But we're going to give you a bestiary experience.
Yes.
And describe to you what you might be seeing as you...
A bestiarience.
Read through, exactly, yeah, an ex-bestiance, as you flip through these pages, as you flip through the pages of your bestiary, and bear in mind as well, and we'll get onto this later, that most bestiaries were beautifully illustrated.
That's where you got so many great illustrations from Weird Medieval Guides, How to Live, Love, Laugh, and Die in Dark Times, available from all good booksellers by Olivia M. Swarthout of this very parish.
Anyway, so imagine some luscious, gold-embellished, beautiful illustrations as you flip through, and I'll link some examples in the show description so you can go through and see all of these amazing drawings that accompanied this artwork.
Suffice to say, it barely even needs to be said at this point, but these are not anatomically accurate drawings.
No.
They are heavily stylized, and also heavily stylized often by somebody who's never seen the animal before.
Correct. So, one of the first animals, or often the first animal in a bestiary, is the lion.
Yes, because they're cool.
Lions are cool. And you know who else was cool?
Me.
Jesus Christ.
Oh, him too, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So the lion is Jesus, right?
The lion is Jesus.
Just like Narnia.
Yeah. I mean, C.S. Lewis, he wasn't, you know, he wasn't original. He basically plagiarized that.
I do love to imagine C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien farting around Oxford, and J.R.R. Tolkien's like, or C.S. Lewis is like, "What have you been up to recently, J.R.R.?" And he's like, "Written another complete language." How's your book going? Put anything new in it?
Yep.
There's a wardrobe.
So, the lion is Jesus for quite a few reasons, and which of these reasons is included depends on the bestiary. So, of course, there are dozens of different...
Is it because Jesus had long, luscious, flowing hair?
Dozens of different bestiary versions that circulated, and each of these were changed and adapted a little bit by the person that was copying them down. But we have a few different things about lions. We have that they sleep with their eyes open. We have that when they are being stalked through the mountains, they erase their tracks with their tail so they can't be followed. We have that someone who bows down before a lion that's about to attack him will be spared by the lion and allowed to leave. That lions only kill when they're hungry and never commit excessive acts of violence. And we also are told in quite a few cases that lion cubs are born dead and lay dead for 3 days. And then one of their parent lions roars over their body and they come to life.
I wonder who also, if there's any other examples of anybody else who died and then laid dead for 3 days and then their dad woke them up.
Yeah, so it's a very Christ-like metaphor right out of the gates.
Yeah.
And we get told all sorts of other reasons why these behaviors make them like Christ. They sleep with their eyes open because when Christ's body was in the cave, his spirit was still watching from heaven. We get told that he... the virtues of being merciful and of not killing in excess are, of course, you know, broadly applicable, but are in particular with regards to Christ's preaching of kindness.
And thou shalt not kill
understanding,
unless.
Understanding, exactly, unless you're really hungry. So the lion is the subject of much praise in the bestiary, and I think it's no surprise that it was such a, I don't think that should be surprising to anyone, considering lions' places in folklore and culture around the world.
I mean, it makes sense, again, because lions are the apex predator. They're an apex predator. They're the sort of, quote-unquote, king of the beasts.
And they are quite majestic.
They're very majestic. They're very cool. Big fan of lions.
Yeah.
Although, again, the male lion is just a useless sack of shit.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Metrosexual fucking cats, man.
All cats are metrosexual.
Yeah, actually. True.
They all look like they're wearing lycra.
So some bestiaries...
And they're all mammals.
I'm just going to make a comment about, you know, cougars wearing lycra, but never mind.
Yeah, boy.
So...
Cougars do love leopard print.
It's true. Yes. So Some bestiaries include an entry for something called an ant lion, which is a hybrid between an ant and a lion that's formed by, you guessed it, an ant and a lion having sex.
Yes!
Wait, how does that work anatomically?
Don't ask.
I'm asking.
No, there is no answer.
Oh.
No one explains. Also, no
Listen,
one...
Listen, when a mummy lion loves an ant very much...
Exactly. But we're told that because... So this is a creature that's, I think...
Please just hang on. Before we get into this, describe it visually.
You know what? Let me get up a picture.
So it's a lion. The first half of it is a lion. And then it has this incredible, like, cinched waist that tapers out into this. And then there's, like, an incredibly... rotund, what's the
thorax?
Yeah, an incredibly rotund thorax at the end with six legs and a what looks like a stinger. What's the size of this thing meant to be?
Is I it don't meant, know.
Would you rather fight?
Oh no.
16 ant-sized ant lions or one lion-sized ant lion?
16? That's not that many. Definitely those.
Oh yeah, that's a good point. Ants aren't that small. Big.
I'd step on them all back. With 1 foot. So, yeah, and so we're told that one of the myriad issues with the antlion is that each part has, you know, retains the nature of the original creature, and so the lion front half will only eat meat, but the ant back half can only digest grain, and so the antlion immediately starves to death upon birth.
It's like a panda.
Yep. And I don't know if there's a moral lesson that yes.
Don't do
here.
Frankenstein
yeah.
stuff. I love Isidore of Seville's etymology of it.
Yeah.
The ant lion is so called either because it is equally lion or ant, or because it is the lion of ants.
Yep.
That's the kind of stuff that Isidore is coming out with.
Yeah. It says it's a little beast and an enemy to ants. That's sad. Wow.
It lives in the sand and it kills other ants. So it sounds like it's ant-sized.
Yeah, maybe. I think it sounds nice.
If I was an ant, right? And I
Would
saw...
Would you still love me if I was an ant?
Of course.
Okay.
If I was an ant, mm-hmm. and I saw, a guy that had the front half of him was a lion, I would just go home.
Yeah.
I'd be like, I'm not carrying any leaves today. I am actually taking the day off.
Yeah,
thank you very much. I'm the first ant in history to take a holiday.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine its roar. It'd be like,
And we have a note, by the way. I'm going to be relating some of these animal entries to Isidore's etymologies because I
yes.
think they're quite fun, the way he ties them in. So he
Excuse
says
me.
That the lion is called lion, which in Latin is Leo, because it comes from the Greek word leon, which means lion. He doesn't seem to have, like...
Wait, hang on.
I think...
A lion is called a lion because it comes from the word lion.
Yeah, he doesn't really give a good explanation for this one, actually. He says that the word...
You think?
He says that
it's perfectly circular.
Well, yeah, he says that it comes from a word that means king, but he's not really quite as specific with this one. I think the lion is a...
No, the ant lion is much easier to explain.
The ant lion is much easier to explain, especially because... The Latin name for it is Myrmecolion, which means...
Antlion.
Yeah, you got it. So, on to the next one.
Yes.
In fact, you know, I think I should be asking you for each of these if they are good, if you think they will be good or bad in the Christian
yeah.
worldview.
Okay, so I think lion obviously is good because the lion is Jesus.
Yes.
Antlion is neutral.
Antlion seems to be neutral.
Because it's a lion, but it's also an ant.
We don't
As
really...
we've discussed.
Exactly.
As Isidore has helpfully explained.
Exactly. So, up next we have the bear.
I think bear good.
Bear Good, yes, yeah. Indeed.
I mean, you see a lot of bears on heraldry.
Mm-hmm.
They're strong, they're tough, they're sort of independent. They're probably great to cuddle.
Oh, they look so cuddly. So, we find...
It's called a bear because it looks like a large, gay, hairy man.
Exactly. So we have a few different stories about the bear. One of the reasons purportedly why they're good that's repeated in some bestiaries is because they have sex missionary style. Like humans. I don't actually know if they do that.
And everybody knows that missionary style is the holiest of styles.
Well, that's why it's called that.
Yeah! looking tenderly into the eyes of my bear lover. I love you so much, baby.
Let's make some bear cubs.
Bears are Mormons.
Okay.
Is there anything else about them?
Yes,
or does
yes,
it just say
there is.
They fuck normal?
That's actually not the main thing about bears. So the main thing about bears is that when their babies are born, they are basically like shapeless lumps of flesh.
To be fair, I've watched a lot of David Attenborough. That is pretty much true.
They do look pretty raw. And so we're told that after the shapeless little lump of bear flesh is born, the mother bear then licks it into shape. She sculpts her cub into a proper little baby bear with her tongue.
That's amazing.
And you actually have a phrase in English called lick into shape, which means to kind of, you know, form something or shape someone or something the way that you want, which has falsely been attributed to, you know, like whipping, but actually comes from this myth about bears. And so Isidore of Seville says that bear in Latin ursus is so called because it shapes its offspring in its own mouth, which in Latin own mouth is ore suo.
That's so, a stretch.
Ursus, ore
that's like
suo,
not even
ursus.
That's barely even a similar sound.
And so the would you like to guess the moral comparison that's being brought in by saying that the bear shapes its offspring?
Be a good parent.
Yes, be a good parent in general, and also not just to shape people the way that you think is moral, but allow yourself to be shaped by your church and your community and by God.
Yeah, because if I was a bear mother having to, and I had my bear lump, to turn into a cub, I might want to get creative with it and make it a different shape.
Yeah.
Like, what if I made just, like, a bear that was just, like, human-shaped?
Well, yeah, that's why people weren't trusted with the, you know, the sculpting. So, up next we've got the wolf.
Awoo!
Good? Bad?
I'm gonna say bad. It's a predator, eats your sheep. Bad.
Yep. Indeed, the wolf is bad. And so we have absolutely amazing stories about the wolf. So we're told that if a wolf sees a man before the man sees the wolf, the man will be dumbstruck. He will lose his voice.
I do feel that way when I see a wolf.
But if a man sees a wolf before the wolf sees the man, then the wolf will be scared and run away. However, you don't need to worry if you lost your voice because a wolf saw you, because all you need to do is take off all of your clothes in front of the wolf.
I'm not afraid of you, wolf, look.
And pick up two rocks and bang them together, which will keep the wolf from attacking you.
Because the wolf will just be like, huh?
That would be my reaction.
What is this? I don't want to eat this, whatever this is. This sucks.
And so Isidore gives us a few different good etymology options. Wolf in Latin is lupus, which he gives one explanation for that's that this comes from the word for lion, Leo, and the word for paw, which is pes. So it's an animal with feet like a lion, which
I guess. But it's not, though. It's not, but it's not, though. Because it's a dog and a cat.
That's true. Well, he probably had never seen a wolf.
He might have seen a wolf.
There might have still been lions in Spain at that point. I don't know. Would you like to guess what the moral allegory is?
Honestly, I don't have a clue.
This one is maybe a bit more tenuous, but basically the wolf represents sin and the devil, as, you know, supposedly evil creatures often do.
And to fight sin, you gotta get naked and start banging.
Well, you need to be baptized to clean yourself of sin and strip off all of your kind of worldly acquisitions. So up next, we've got absolutely amazing one. One of my favorite medieval animals, which is the hedgehog. Like Sonic.
Like Sonic.
Like Sonic. We got Sonic Hedgehog. So, Hedgehog, good or bad?
Judging by the Sonic the Hedgehog games, good.
Hedgehog, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Hedgehog actually depends, but in most sources, Hedgehog, good. So the Hedgehog is a creature that apparently, according to medieval bestiaries, uses its sharp spines to roll over fruit, like apples and grapes, and carry them home to its children.
It's so cute.
It's so cute, and it wasn't, if you compare it to the lion and the dragon and the wolf and animals that actually appear in the Bible, the hedgehog is not a significant animal.
It's not narratively significant.
The hedgehog is kind of like the Tom Bombadil of the bestiary, and that it's there and it actually features quite prominently. So most bestiaries have hedgehogs, and also even bestiaries that don't illustrate every animal usually illustrate the hedgehog, and more specifically illustrate the myth of it carrying fruit on its spines.
Because it's vivid and fun.
Very, very cute. And we also get a lot of really cute other kind of corollary myths. So there's one about how hedgehogs always know what direction the wind is going to blow in and will build and block the entrances to their dens based on that. So if you're a gardener, you should always welcome hedgehogs into your garden because they'll forecast the weather for you. So the hedgehog in Latin is Herinaceus, and I think in French, this is, they're called like a Hirschon or something.
Yes, Hirschon.
So it's related to the word for, the word urchin. I think actually in English they used to be called urchins. So sea urchin is a word that means sea hedgehog. Yeah. Right. So as far as moral allegories go, we don't get a lot on the hedgehog, which only reaffirms my belief that medieval people just liked these guys a lot and thought they were cute.
Well, they're just supporting characters,
They're so cute.
Miss Tiggy Winkle.
Yes! You ever see a hedgehog, you know, just on the streets?
Oh, yeah. I've met hedgehogs.
And Isidore of Seville, as I was saying, says that hedgehogs are called Ericium because this is related to the word erect, basically, because their quills stiffen when they want to defend themselves.
So, fair enough.
Yeah.
Sensible. I kind of think that makes sense.
Yeah. You know what? Good job, Isidore. Okay. So the next beast we're going to talk about is the centaur. That is a human combined with half of a horse, or in some sources, it's called an onocentaur, which is a human combined with an ass, which is to say, a donkey.
Do you really think so little of me?
Yeah, very good. And the centaur is, in the bestiary, a symbol of
donkey!
Yes, it's the dangers of donkey. No, it's a symbol of lust. In particular, male lust.
Okay, can I make a suggestion as to why?
Mm-hmm.
It's an anatomical observation about horses, specifically male horses.
Indeed, yes. So that's, I think, a big part of it and why that particular animal was chosen. And the specific nature of the beast that's drawn out in a lot of the bestiaries is that it has the head, so symbolically, you know, the mind, perhaps, of a human, but it has the body, and so the impulses of a beast.
I'm so horny all the time!
Exactly, and centaurs, I think both in classical mythology and also in bestiaries, are known for their wild parties and for being, you know, kind of boors, essentially, and being wild creatures.
They're like the frat boys of the medieval ecosystem. Yeah,
they kind of are. Like, I found a manuscript where there's a drawing of a centaur, and he just has, like, the thickest mustache ever. He really looks like he's, you know, just rolled up to a...
Yo, my name's Chad. Chad Thundercock.
Yeah. So in particular, the lesson is not to let yourself be guided by desires of the flesh and to instead follow your mind.
But consider this. The centaur's life sounds pretty cool.
They do sound like they have more fun. Yes, this is true.
Oh no, don't follow the desires of the flesh. Otherwise, you'll end up having kick-ass parties with your boys.
With your horse boys.
And riding really fast.
Exactly. So, up next we've got the unicorn.
Okay, so unicorns, this is interesting, right? Because one of the interesting things about unicorns is these are one of the animals that we do have material records from.
Yes.
So, or, you know, which is just not to say that unicorns are real, but there were artifacts that people thought were unicorn horns, specifically narwhal tusks.
Yes.
And I think it's brilliant. This is a brilliant story because these were being imported by Norsemen from Greenland and northern Canada, and it's entirely possible that the Inuit people who are selling the hunting the narwhals and selling the horns didn't know what the Christians thought the horns were. And the Norsemen didn't necessarily know that they weren't unicorns. So it seems like there was a little bit of a sort of collapse of Chinese whispers.
Yeah.
In this, where everybody's like, you know, the Inuit are like, these people really love narwhals.
Yeah, that's the most charitable interpretation of the economy of narwhal horns, so I applaud you for that, because you're clearly trying to assume the best out of this, like, opportunistic trading system.
Well, that's what some historians have posited. I mean, there's obviously the more critical version, which is to say that a Norseman went up to an Inuit guy and was like, is that a unicorn horn? And the guy was like, yes.
Or just that the Norsemen were hunting them themselves.
Well, I do like the communication breakdown explanation, not just because it speaks better to the people involved, but also I think because it explains why it never got out.
Yeah.
That these were not actually unicorns, because
definitely
people took this seriously.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
One of the myths about alicorns, as they called unicorn horns, was that they were... could dispel poison or were resistant to poison. And so quite a lot of the time, if you were a wealthy nobleman, you would have an alicorn on your table. Yes. Where you could either put it near your food or dip it in your food. And the myth was that if there was poison in the food, then the horn would sweat. So you would sit there and watch the unicorn horn to see if it changed at all. And I think this is endlessly interesting for two reasons. Number one, because people were clearly believed in these stories enough to actually spend actual real money on these things and use them. But also because there was also an intense scholarly debate about why the unicorn horns had that reaction, which is fascinating personally, because the entire debate is structured around... It's like a scientific debate. We've observed this phenomenon, but how do we explain it?
Yeah.
About something that's not real.
Yeah. It's
like nobody's questioning whether or not these are unicorn horns, and B, if they do anything.
Well, yeah, I think the unicorn. I have two things to say about unicorns, which is that
they're
beautiful. The horns were also sold as medicine and kind of as a cure-all, and so you could drink some unicorn horn dissolved in water to cure all sorts of ailments, and the fact that powdered unicorn horn could be used then, of course, introduced all sorts of other things that weren't even narwhal horns into the economy, where if you were a poor person, you could get, you know, sold something that was described as powdered unicorn horn by some sketchy street doctor, but was probably just ground up rocks or something.
You there, you my good friend, you look like you need...
powdered unicorn horn.
Powdered unicorn horn for male potency. I take it myself.
Do you want to see?
Second. I am bold like Cinto.
Second, this is slightly tangential, but the French word for unicorn, which is licorne.
Oh, is come on.
What?
Le unicorn.
Yeah, so this is one of my favorite kind of etymological stories. So it used to be that the French word for unicorn was unicorn. And through a series, through an etymological process called rebracketing, this got reinterpreted. So instead of saying un unicorn, people thought unicorn was the way
yes!
to say it. So unicorn just became ecorn. It was unicorn, which then would be said, you know, the unicorn would be said as le ecorn or licorne. Which then got reinterpreted again as one word. So now it's la licorne, I think, or le licorne. I forget which one. So
is etymology fun?
So, up next, and I hope you're enjoying these, because we've got quite a few more to go through. The elephant.
Olifant.
Oh, well, the elephant. Elephant just means, like, large, like elephantine, which the word, like, huge, is where the word elephant comes from.
Right, okay.
So elephant is just a...
So the first person to see an elephant just pointed at it and went big.
Yep, basically. Elephants were an animal that, despite not being necessarily common in medieval Europe, although there were a few of them kicking about, there was an English king who had an elephant in his menagerie, which led to probably the only anatomically accurate drawing of an animal... that was created in medieval Europe. And it is it's a pretty good one for someone who's clearly just sketching from memory.
Yeah, they call the elephant Stampy.
No, but it is pink in the drawing, which I really like.
Yes!
Yeah.
Like in Dumbo!
It's on parade. So the elephant has a lot of myths associated with it. I should ask you as well, elephants good or bad?
I think they're good, because they are sort of... they're social creatures. They are... not, you know, they have good vibes.
They come across as quite benevolent, don't they?
Yeah, they're just sort of, I mean, they're obviously terrifying and huge, and they can be used in battle to terrifying effect if you're so inclined. But, like, when it's an elephant when it's at home.
Yeah, definitely.
Just a chill big beast.
An elephant that's just chilling. So, yes, you are correct. The elephant was considered to be a quote-unquote good creature, and there are lots of, stories that we get about elephants. Elephants can't stand up.
What?
And so to avoid falling over, they will lean against trees while they sleep.
That's very cute.
This means that the way to hunt an elephant is to cut through the tree while the elephant is sleeping and knock it over. And so the elephant is not able to stand up, but the...
Well, wait, hang on. But how does it, like, move around?
It can't... if it falls down, it can't stand
up. Oh, right, okay.
And so then the elephant is not, you know, like a turtle on his back or something. It cries out. Yeah, they probably trumpet SOS, you know.
So on your name, my darling, can't you hear me? SOS.
Exactly. And upon hearing that signal, 12 elephants will arrive and try to lift it up.
Get up, you fat bastard.
Exactly.
You've had too much grass, mate.
So then, allegedly, they will fail to lift up the elephant until another smaller elephant comes along and adds his strength, and then they will successfully lift up the elephant.
So that's one of the most obvious, like, that's a parable.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
Right, yeah. So the 12 elephants represent... the prophets, and we're told that with these sort of worldly forces, it's not enough to raise humanity up out of sin and into heaven, and the small elephant is Christ, who, you know, whose might is what allows us to be elevated.
So he's the little elephant, the baby elephant.
He's the baby elephant. Christ is the baby elephant, yes.
I endorse that.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Never in danger, quaileth our fathers.
So, moving on, we're going to do some birds.
Hell yeah.
Let's do...
Love me some birds.
Let's do the eagle.
Okay, what about the eagle? Obviously, it's America.
The eagle, what do you think, good or bad?
Obviously good. Yep. Roman.
Everyone loves an eagle. So the eagle metaphor is really good. The eagle life story is that they live forever.
Oh.
And when not, they... Sorry.
That's not my experience.
And however, they are not resistant to aging. And so when an eagle gets really, really old and gross looking and can't go on anymore, it flies all the way up to the sky. And into the light of the sun, and the sun burns away its old feathers and burns away the mist from its eyes, and then, unable to fly, the eagle falls down into the ocean and is washed clean, and then, when it emerges, begins to grow new feathers and is like a new eagle again.
Okay. So is that... Okay, here's my guess as to what that is. Is that... Confession?
Yes.
Yes!
Well done. Oh,
for anybody who isn't in the room with us, that was a completely called shot. Yeah. Shall I explain that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because, you know, you get, like, you know, you sin, bad stuff happens to you, whatever, you get all messed up. Then you go towards the light of the Lord.
Yes.
And, things come to light because you confess your sins, and then you're washed clean, and you can start again.
Yeah, and in general, I think it's a general metaphor for finding God, you know, flying towards the light. And I think you could also draw out a theme of baptism, of, you know, being purified by the water. So,
hell yeah.
Yeah, eagles good. There's also a really good one that I like. There's a really good eagle story that I like as well, that eagles' eyes are so strong, they can look directly into the sun without their eyes being burned. And
just
when,
like Donald Trump.
Exactly. And when they have babies, the eagle mother forces the eagle chicks to look directly into the sun. If the eagle chicks turn their eyes away, they will get thrown out of the nest.
Look at it! Look at it! But I don't want to look at it! I'm
going to
throw you out of my house. No child of mine won't look at the damn sun.
So, yeah, this is, I think, a pretty... You know, pretty clear themes in this metaphor as well. Specifically, one bestiary, the Aberdeen Bestiary, says that this is about how angels will sort out the worthy from the unworthy and lift them up.
Throw them into the sea.
Or throw them into the pit. Yeah, exactly. And so the eagle etymology that Isidore of Sigville gives, eagle is aquila or aquila. I don't actually know how that's pronounced in Latin. Sorry. And that basically comes from the same root word as the word acuity or accuracy. Huh. So he says that it comes from specifically the term acumen oculorum, which somehow, I guess, became aquila.
Sure.
That, oops. And that's just a phrase that means keen vision. So... That's eagles. Okay, oh, up next, this is a really good one. Have you heard of the Caladrius bird?
Oh, only in passing.
This is one that I really like. This is a mythical all-white bird that I think is supposed to live in Egypt. And if you're sick and a Caladrius bird shows up, I don't know how or why exactly, although apparently they like to hang out around the palaces of royalty. If the Caladrius bird looks you in the eyes, then you will be healed, you will recover, and if it looks away, you will die. And in particular, some texts specify that the Caladrius bird will, like, suck all of the illness out of your body and fly away with it, which I quite like. And you even get a couple where, like, the bird kind of looks like it's kissing someone that's in bed.
Come here, give me a smooch.
Yeah, exactly. Kiss it and make it better. That must be the origins. Yeah, and that's, again, I think probably not too hard to pull out some Christian themes. So the bird is all white, of course.
Yeah.
It's spiritually pure.
Can I ask how many of these animals are Jesus?
Most of them. They're either Jesus or the devil.
Yeah.
in general. Yeah. And we're told that because Christ turned his face, you know, from unbelievers, and particularly the Jews, but looked towards the Christians and the believers and gave them redemption.
Which is a slightly odd thing to say, given that he was a Jew.
Yeah, well, they'd had a few centuries to kind of, you know.
There wasn't such a thing as Jews versus Christians.
Yeah, exactly.
Then. It was just like, hey, there's this cool guy, what do you think of him?
Let's see. Oh, let's do bees.
This is my Aaron's controversial take that medieval people were too mean to Jews. Okay,
so,
bees.
So bees and bees, good or bad? First of all,
obviously good. They're obviously, workers. They're productive.
Yes, and so bees in medieval bees, you know, busy as a bee. It's a general metaphor. I think it's pretty easy to. It's a general metaphor for productivity and being a productive member of society. One big difference between medieval bees and modern bees is medieval bees, according to the bestiaries.
The bestiaries.
I knew you were gonna say that. Is that bees are a patriarchal society.
What?
Makes sense for bees, not in real life, just, you know, in the text. Which I think makes sense for people that probably couldn't tell what gender a bee was, that they would assume they have a king, not a queen.
Let me, pass me this magnifying glass. I'm gonna find out if this bee's got a pussy.
A bussy. So, yeah, there's a lot of great conceptions about bees, which I love. They're all pretty clearly just telling you to work hard and not put, you know, rock the boat too much. So we get told that the bees are democratic. They actually elect the king and they choose him because they think that he is the most fit for leading, which on one hand sounds, I guess, democratic, but on the other hand, I think was maybe, you know, used to emphasize that kings are kings because they are the people that are the most fit to rule.
And also displays a lot of optimism about the sort of mental capacity of a bee.
Yeah, so we get told in a few different bestiaries, actually, that bees are the next smartest animals after people, which I really like. And because they fly, they're usually categorized as birds.
Listen, there's three things I know about bees. One, they have penises. Two,
venuses.
Two, they do democracy. And three, they're birds.
And we get told that bees are really strict rule followers, that they actually have bee laws, and that...
Do they have a bee parliament?
I don't know if they have a barlament, but they will commit ritual buicide if they break the bee laws out of shame. And we have an etymology from Isidore of Seville, so bee in Latin is apis, which he separates out into a and pes, so... without feet, and he says this is because bees don't have feet.
Again! They do, though! You can see them!
Well, they have legs.
Yeah, and they got little feet at the end.
We got the pelican. This yes. is another good one. Good or bad, pelican?
Bad. Murder.
Wrong!
What?
Pelican good. Pelican good murder.
Why? Because of... Look, are pelicans good because you can climb in their mouth and they fly you away?
So, pelicans? No, unfortunately not. Here's the pelican story and why the pelican kills her children. So the pelican lays her eggs, the children hatch, but as they grow, they begin to become violent and to strike out at their mother.
Pretty much the same as like human children then.
Basically, yeah. And so,
teenagers, am I right?
Yeah. And so eventually, in a fit of rage, the mother pelican kills all of her children.
Teenagers, am I right?
Yeah, exactly. Then, panicking, you know, realizing what she's done and how wrong it is, you know, oh no, I killed my pelican kids. Then the mother pelican bends down and pierces her own breast with her beak. I should mention at this point that in most medieval drawings of pelicans, they kind of look like eagles, so if you're wondering how that works anatomically with a pelican beak, it doesn't, I don't think. And then she pours the blood over her children, and they are brought back to life.
Damn.
So.
Is this one Jesus as well?
This one is Jesus!
God damn it!
Well done!
Because, you know, it's the blood and the bringing back to life.
Yeah, it's a bit of a muddled metaphor, because I think, you know.
Because Jesus did not lash out irrationally and murder people.
No, exactly. But there is a general, you know, apart from the general resurrection theme, there is also, you know, that the pelican babies, the pelican mother is Jesus, and the pelican babies are the people who betrayed Jesus or who didn't believe and were struck down, but then through Jesus's blood they can be redeemed. So that's pretty hopeful.
Is it?
If you're a pelican baby, definitely.
Free and unguarded, thanks all the greenhouse.
Fish. We've got whales, which are a type of fish in the Middle Ages.
As well documented in Moby Dick.
So, whales, good or bad?
Well, they did eat Jonah, is the thing.
Yes, they did.
So I'm going to say bad.
Good. Glad you're not letting them get away with that. Yes, whales are bad.
I ain't never forgiven whales ever since they did to my mate Jonah.
Whale, bad, devil. The whale metaphor is that whales are so big they look like islands. And
yes.
Sailors moor their ships upon the whales and climb out and light a fire. The whale doesn't like this, so it
can't imagine
out
why.
And drags them down to the depths.
Something that has never happened ever.
And also, I don't know how you can get out of this that the whale is evil, because who was the one that lit it on fire?
Yeah.
Nevertheless, this is used as a metaphor to say that, you know, the devil is lurking everywhere in disguise, and if you're not careful, he will grab you and drag you down to the depths with him. Another creature of the sea that we have in bestiaries is sirens.
Yes, they sing really well, makes you want to sleep with them, but they've got chicken legs.
Yeah, so we've got a lot of different siren metaphors and siren depictions. I think you can imagine whether they're good or bad.
How misogynistic are they?
Very. All of them are misogynistic, just in different ways.
Okay, great.
So just as the centaur is this kind of virile, domineering figure that encapsulates the dangers of male sexuality, the female siren encapsulates the dangers of female sexuality.
How so? Because she sings really good and it makes you want to go and go to her place.
Well, exactly. She's a temptress. She's a tart.
Look, I respect all women, including women who have chicken legs. Would.
Well, so it's interesting as well because over the course of the Middle Ages, there was a slow shift in how sirens were depicted. So sirens are also, especially in later depictions, shown as mermaids, right? The mermaids singing on the rock, they kind of get conflated with mermaids. And so there's a shift from kind of evil bird hag to
sexy
beautiful
fish woman.
And this transformation, you know, had especially taken place by the High Middle Ages when a lot of bestiaries were written, which has led some scholars to say that they kind of encapsulate a very specific Christian worldview, this danger of beauty. And
oh no.
Female temptress.
What if a beautiful woman seduces me? That would be terrible.
Well, it's what happens after she seduces you.
It's a price I'm willing to pay. You're implying that's not part of the appeal.
It is part of the, you know, mating process for a lot of animals, I guess. So, fish in general are kind of a neutral figure. I mean, they're mostly good. Mostly good in the medieval perception. In one bestiary, it's said that Pliny the Elder has told us that there are 144 kinds of fish in the ocean, which is actually a pretty conservative guess if you compare it to the number of species of fish that there actually are. Not 144 fish total, just different types of fish. But like most of them get grouped together by medieval people as just fish, unless they have something that distinguishes them from other fish. So we've got, for instance, crabs, which are a type of fish.
Wait a minute. Okay, hang on. Whales, I'm okay with because it's fish-shaped. Crabs is not fish.
You know, they live in the water, so that was the best that, you know, they could do.
Not all the time.
Well, you know what? I'm being very pedantic right now.
Yeah, you are.
Let us then throw our death where we are rolling.
Okay. Let's finish off with some serpents. You're going to love all of the things that fall into the category of serpents.
Yes!
Such as frogs and toads.
Frogs and toads! So let me guess. Okay, I think I know the frog and toad parable. There's a frog and he comes to visit his friend Toad, who's lying in bed. And his friend Toad is sad because it's winter and it's crap and it's raining. And Frog is like, have you considered going outside and walking around the corner of your house? And the toad is like, no. And then they do that. and it's spring.
Wow. Yeah, that's it. And this is representative of sin.
Guess what? The toad is Jesus again.
Yep.
The frog was also Jesus.
Yep. So, yeah, can you guess in the medieval mind, frogs and toads, good or bad?
I'm going to say bad. Yes. Because they're sort of slimy and they're slippery characters, you know?
Yeah, there's not really a metaphor there, which I think just frogs and toads don't do that much. I think it's sad because there's no reason to hate them. Like, they don't say anything really about them. Just people seem to think they were gross.
Sometimes they sail around on paddle steamers and play in a band.
This is true, I guess. You know, that God forbid frogs have hobbies. One thing that I do like about toads is that there's a myth that toads have a jewel inside of their head, which unfortunately can only be acquired by killing the toad, but it's called a toadstone, and apparently if you wear it as a ring, it will protect you from poison.
That is the most Terry Pratchett-ass thing I've ever heard in my life.
It is.
Toadstone sounds like one of, like, a late-period Discworld book.
And there were actual stones that were passed off to people as toadstones, so...
Check out this rock.
Yeah.
I got it from a frog. You're like, okay, whatever, man.
Yeah. But probably, arguably, the most significant serpent in the medieval mind was the dragon.
Bad. Obviously bad.
Dragon Satan.
Yes.
Yeah, so dragons are depicted in a lot of different ways in the Middle Ages. Sometimes they're very big, sometimes they look rather like the modern fantasy dragon, sometimes they're very serpentine, very long, and they are more like snakes. Although sometimes they are also depicted as being sort of mammalian. And this label of serpent is kind of just a spiritual one, because dragons are very much representative of the devil. You know, they spit out hellfire, and...
And I'll do other cool shit like that.
Yeah, exactly. And basically just, you know, fly around and try to kill you. In some stories, they guard pepper trees and other things in the Far East.
Sometimes you gotta go kill them.
Yep, exactly.
To save a maiden.
Yeah.
Maidens always do be needing saving.
But some of my favorite bestiary stories are where you get crossover events between different animals. Well, we have a few, actually. One is that dragons are afraid of a particular type of tree called a paradoxian tree, and they'll stay away from it, and so doves roost in the tree to be safe from the dragon. And so doves is the symbol of purity, being protected by the majestic tree from the evil dragon. Pretty straightforward. And we also have stories about dragons and elephants, and that dragons will lie in wait for elephants and so they can catch them by their tail and kill them. Or sometimes,
not the, like, easiest part of an elephant to catch.
No, it's not. But, so the elephant is, you know, coming back as a metaphor for good, to emphasize how bad the dragon is. Sometimes categorized with serpents are worms, which...
They are the same shape.
I guess it makes sense. And so we get told, that worms are spontaneously generated from things like rotting flesh and soil.
And if you take enough psychedelic drugs, you can turn into one.
Yes.
Dune reference. True.
And so most actual insects are called worms in medieval writing, which I like. And worms...
Wait, so if you saw a butterfly, you'd be like, that's a serpent.
A butterfly is a worm with wings.
If you say so.
Yeah. And we even get sort of this particular descriptions of what different worms are spontaneously generated from. So worms are spontaneously generated from clothing, which makes sense. And earthworms are generated from soil.
Wow.
And something called a woodworm is spontaneously generated from wood. So that's worms. So there's more. There's a lot I could have gone on for quite some time, as you can imagine, about the different animals in medieval bestiaries.
And you have.
And I have, but I could have gone on for even more time. But let's draw this section to a close now.
I had so much fun learning about all the animal facts.
There's so many more. Again, I'm going to link an English language edition of a bestiary, and I highly recommend you just flip through, and I'll link some images as well for you guys to look through.
On gentle Norland, we strike far across.
So that's what medieval people thought about animals. A whistle-stop tour through some of the mythology and ideas that are floating around in these manuscripts. But I think what we haven't really answered yet is, why did they make these? So why did they do it?
Well, so there's a few things to mention about bestiaries. First of all, like I said before, there's a lot of different bestiary texts and bestiary versions, and bestiaries have even been grouped into families by people who study them based on when they were made, where they were made, what bestiary they were copied from. And so this gives us a pretty good idea of how bestiaries spread throughout Europe. And so we know that bestiaries began to be a thing as distinct from, say, the Physiologus or from the etymologies or other classical source texts around the 9th or the 10th century, but they really reached their apex around the High Middle Ages, so especially the 12th, the 13th, and a little bit in the 14th century. You have these lavish, beautifully illustrated bestiaries being made. And you also have kind of spin-off texts. So one French guy named Hugh de... I honestly can't pronounce his name, so I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It's Fouilloy. I'm never going to say that. I'm just going to call him Hugh from now on.
So Hugh.
So Hugh...
Hugh de Fun.
De Fun. De Pneu. Wrote a book called the, well, it's got different titles. In English, it's often referred to as the Aviary, so it's just about birds, which, relatable. and
I'm all about the birds.
So we don't know where or who, we don't know who made the original bestiaries or where they're from, but we know they were in large part made in monastic communities as instructional books. And that they were then passed around, so maybe you would have a monk who arrived at your monastery to copy down your bestiary, or maybe you would lend it to another monastery or another abbey to let them copy it down, and so they were disseminated this way. It's hard to know exactly what the specific motivations were for creating bestiaries, but one thing that I was reading about that I think makes sense as an explanation, at least in part, is that they were definitely tools that could easily be used to teach people who were not educated clergy, so lay society, because they have these simple to understand messages. They draw on a pre-existing body of folklore that people would already be familiar with, and everything is kind of presented in these bite-sized pieces with a very clear metaphor. And one thing to note as well is that the rise of bestiaries corresponds with an increase in the number of monastic orders and the founding of a lot of important monastic orders, such as the Cistercians, in particular in England and France, where most of the bestiaries were made. They were especially an English thing, but there are a few French ones as well.
There's a couple of German ones, but it's like most of these, the majority, in fact, I'd say over two-thirds of the surviving bestiaries and records of bestiaries that we have are in England.
Yes, and there was also a later book that was made in France called The Bestiary of Love that's not about Jesus, it's about romance.
Put a pin in that. We're going to come back to that in a future episode, I think, because yeah, that sounds brilliant.
It is really good. love lessons from animals, so...
You see, just like the bear does it.
When these monastic orders were being founded and abbeys were being founded, there was a big emphasis on self-sufficiency and an ascetic life. Because you're a monk, you're not supposed to be buying and selling things or participating in economy in the outside world and worldly matters. In general, you're supposed to be sitting inside, writing things with your quill by candlelight.
Thinking about Jeebus.
Eating hard bread. Unfortunately, the amount of transferable skills that the average abbey or monastery possessed wasn't always very large. You have people who are made for writing and reading and have been given an education but may not necessarily know how to, say, shoe a horse or cobble a road.
It's a bunch of nerds trying to set up their own hippie commune.
Help a sheep give birth, like, you know. These are very much the indoor kids. and they might not always have the skills they need to actually keep the place up and running. And so one idea that was put into action was, well, we can take a bunch of peasants and basically tell them that they're monks, make them take monastic vows. We're not going to let them pursue an education or be literate, because what we need them to do is just do their jobs, but specifically for us, and we'll feed them, and we will give them job security, and in exchange, they basically have to swear off sex and promise to live a monastic life.
Sounds like a pretty bad deal.
I know. Well, you have to remember, this was at the time when serfdom, for instance, was one of the main jobs. Serf was one of the main jobs people had.
Listen.
Yeah.
You're telling me that my two options for employment are be a monk or go surfing. I know what I'd pick.
Yeah, surf and turf. That was the medieval lifestyle. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to say, because I think being a monk would have felt a bit like living in a panopticon. You have to constantly be praying and showing up at church, and there's always guys breathing down your neck.
And there's no hot babes.
Yeah, but surf, I mean, there's not that many hot babes, you know, and your landlord can prevent you from marrying a hot babe, which isn't cool. I think it probably would have been a situational thing. Like, if you had a cool abbot, I can understand why becoming a lay brother, as it was called, so a peasant who joined a monastic order. I can see why it would have been tempting, but you can also see why, when they did enact this, not everyone was always obedient all the time. So of course we even, you know, have stories of monks and of members of the clergy not obeying their vows, as they often do. But in particular, it seems like there were issues with just bringing in, you know, basically a large number of tradespeople and expecting them to keep on the straight and narrow, especially because some abbeys in the 12th century, I think, banned ale, which caused riots.
So you can't drink, you can't fornicate,
mm-hmm.
You're not allowed to learn anything.
Yeah.
This sucks.
I know.
If only I had a sort of compendium of cool animal stories to keep me entertained.
And so Hugh, who wrote his aviary, he, even though we don't know who wrote the first bestiary, we have a foreword or a prologue from Hugh, who wrote a pretty comparable text. And he says in it specifically, this is for those people. This is to make it easier for them to learn about Jesus and be good people. In particular, he says, because I must write for the unlettered, the diligent reader should not wonder that, for the instruction of the unlettered, I say simple things about subtle matters. Nor should he attribute it to levity that I paint a hawk or a dove, because the blessed Job and the prophet David bequeathed to us birds of this sort for our edification. For what scripture means to the teachers, the picture means to simple folk. Just as the learned man delights in the subtlety of the written word, so the intellect of simple folk is engaged by the simplicity of a picture. And this is, you know, of course, very much in line with the Catholic teachings of the time, that you can't really trust the common people to understand scripture on their own. You need to break it down for them. You, as the clergy, are the interface between the people and God, because otherwise they would read something like, men can have six wives, and they'd take it the wrong way. That would undermine the foundations of the whole affair.
No, you have to understand. You can't actually just read the Bible.
Exactly. Are you reading the Bible, or are you reading the Bible? And so, yeah, and this wasn't a new or an unpopular idea at all. This, a similar sentiment was expressed by Gregory the Great in around 600 AD. So it was, you know, the idea that pictures could be used to teach people was a pretty widespread one. And even though we don't necessarily know for all bestiaries that this was the case, you can imagine that a general need to have easy to understand lessons for the lay people, and especially accelerated by the creation of this lay brotherhood, was a big motivating factor in creating these bestiaries, and would also perhaps explain why, when lay brotherhood declined, after people realized it wasn't a fully sustainable model,
that it sucks.
And then something called the Black Death happened, which meant there was suddenly a lot more land going around and you didn't need a feudal lord to rent it out to you. lay brotherhood disappeared, and bestiaries also declined. Their production disappeared, so you don't see them in the late Middle Ages being made at all.
No, they really peak in the 13th century. There's a huge spike.
And this was when tensions, this was when, like, the ale riots were, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's, to attribute bestiary production purely to that is, I think, obviously not something we should do, because, you know, it's not just, of course, using animals to teach lessons isn't just a Christian thing. But I think it's clear that they had a particular attachment to animal stories, and they saw animal stories as being a powerful and natural way to interface with the lay society.
Honor in Hydra, who can refuse her?
I think there's one last thing that we need to unpick in the theory of why bestiaries, which is why stories about animals? Because, you know, the Bible has a lot of compelling stories in it. You don't need to fancy it up with elephants, right? So why animals? And I have a working theory, which I've slightly stolen from some people who I will link below, but also cooked up on my own sleep-deprived brain, which is that I think that animals represent truer closeness to God than the fallen, sinful human world. Which sounds like an incredibly hippie-ish thing to say, and it is, but hear me out. So, what is the inciting incident of history in the Bible? It is the moment when Eve eats that apple, realizes that her titties are just hanging out there.
No!
Thank you for the... And
my Eve impression.
And long story short, they both get clothes and then get thrown out of the Garden of Eden. Now think about what the implications of that are, which is that first of all, the introduction of sin coincides with the introduction of civilization. Because before that, humans were living without knowledge. They were not beasts because they had divine nature, but they were still not fully as we would recognize them humans. They were more animal. It is important, I think, that Adam and Eve's first instinct is to make clothes, because the production of clothes requires increasing levels of technological and economic sophistication to make more and more nicer clothes. So I think there is a connection here between human civilization and sin that I think is expressive of an anxiety about the sinful nature of the society that they're living in. And by the way, when the Bible depicts the end of the world, the sort of the full circle of events that will bring us all the way basically back to the start and will reunite us with God, some of the most striking images of the last days of Earth are when we see the four evangelists at the side of God, and they are depicted as either being animals or being animal-human hybrids. So, and of course, you know, the Revelations is full of animal stuff, like the Lamb of God, the beast of the Antichrist.
Yes.
Like animality is spiritual and, dare I say, sacral. In a very supernatural kind of way. And what I think bestiaries speak to by treating animals as emblems and symbols and instruments of divinity, what I think is being said here, given what I've already addressed, is that it's expressive of an underlying anxiety that the natural world is the quote-unquote real world, and that the human world of civilization is this sort of deviant, false spur that was never meant to come to pass and will end when we reunite with God. And I think that, to take this one step further, I think that that's that anxiety, what I would say this is a massive hippie, but like, I think that's a universal anxiety. I think you can see it in in sort of back to the land hippiedom. I think you can see it in a lot of strains of cultural conservatism.
Return to Monkey.
Return to Monkey. Exactly.
I think you can see this reflected in the way that medieval people wrote about animals and how they categorized them as good and evil, because even though there was an attempt to... Because even though, in theory, this was a discussion of animals' true nature and that animals were created for the benefit of people, as is said in the Bible, I mean, Adam names all of the animals and there's this general theme of people, you know, civilizing and cultivating and shaping the land the way that God shapes people. There's also, I think, in bestiaries expressed a really strong fear of the unknown and of the inhuman, but also of things that are a little bit too close to human. So for instance, monkeys and apes are clearly like very unnerving to medieval people and they treat them as, you know, these objects of ridicule, even though, and, you know, of being very uncanny.
And also the half-human, half-animal creatures are pretty much universally treated as sinister.
Exactly. And so are, you know, animals that are representative of the wild and of the unknown. The whale that lives at the bottom of the sea and the wolf that lives in the deep, deep parts of the woods. These are all creatures that are treated as being sinful. And by contrast, creatures like the horse and the dog and, you know, creatures that represent human impact on animals and on the natural worlds are described as being very good and very moral. Yeah, there's a desire, I would say, that you can pull out for humans to kind of make sense of and organize and try to reclaim some power over the natural world, which I think makes sense because even with this idea that the world was made for people, for a lot of medieval people, even educated ones, life was kind of a constant struggle against the elements and against the natural worlds. Maybe a world you felt like you weren't made to live in because you're a human being with a house and you you live in a society.
Yeah. I mean, the insistence that, oh yeah, the world and all the animals were made for the edification of humanity, it does feel a little bit sort of the lady doth protest too much. It's like, trust me, guys, this is all for us. It's definitely not terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
I think, though, that the desire to make sense of animals and to understand them as being extensions of us and connected to us in some way, I don't think that's gone away. And I think that, you know, we started this episode with a riff on the sort of, on the sort of Planet Earth style documentaries. But one of the fascinating things about those shows is the extent to which they are structured and constructed to anthropomorphize animals. Animals are presented in little vignettes, in narratives, where there are goodies and baddies and whimsical characters who are fun and terrifying monsters. And I don't think that any of the anxieties and tensions and contradictions about the human relationship with the natural world that bestiaries express have gone away as much as we like to think they have.
Like, Zootopia is a really good example of how animals are used to, represent human traits. Or, like, The Wind in the Willows, Redwall, mice, good, you know, they're timid and they're
Frog
cute.
Frog and Toad. Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Exactly. Yes. And that, you know, is, in a sense, kind of a movie about a struggle between human and animal nature.
Oh my God, it is.
It is.
So there you go. If you want to understand more about bestiaries, just go watch Wes Anderson's 2009 film, Fantastic Mr. Fox. It's a fantastic movie.
Well, this is why, like, I think animals are so fascinating in culture, because when I describe them as, like, atomic, I think they really are treated that way, as, like, moral particles, you know, that have some sort of innate property or, you know, at least provide some sort of innate expression.
I think that they are, that the anthropomorphization of animals is, if in some ways, a kind of comfort, that there are things that are... That we live in a world where there are things that are simple and things that have natures that are stable and can be trusted and relied on. Whereas people
Yeah.
can't always.
Exactly. I think this is, you know, the human urge, which is funny, upon seeing an animal, whether it's a bison or a bear, is often to approach it, you know. We want to see our nature reflected back at us in the natural world, and I think we're quite afraid that we might look into a creature's eyes and not find ourselves looking back.
No Mormon warrior would shun jeopardy.
Another majestic display. These podcasters toiled for hours to prepare this episode, and now they retreat to their dens, exhausted. Tragically, podcasters are a dying breed, but there is more we can do to support them. You today could support your local podcast ecosystem by leaving a 5-star review and sharing the episode with your friends.
And if you do, you can also...
Wait, who are you? How did you get in
he's having a heart attack.
How did you get in my... How did you get in my recording booth?
I've always been here, David.
Security!
I live in the walls.
Like the unknown.
Yes!
A reference that'll be out of date by the time this episode comes out. Woo! Fucking Glasgow. No, we can't go down the rabbit hole. We have to
end the episode.
I can see the brain.
I know. You can even tell us what you thought about this episode by using the tell us what you think about this episode box on Spotify. If you do, we might read it out on the next episode. Despite the fact that David Attenborough is midway through a screening of Paddington 2, we brought him back into the studio to read these aloud.
This review comes to us from Geraldine, who says, "This is one of the few podcasts that I genuinely lol to. Thanks for all the strange little medieval lads."
So we got one on medieval vampires recently. Listening to the back catalog, it says, this is from Rika, says, "Second half was genuinely horrifying. I need to sleep with the lights on now. My compliments to the chef." I'm so sorry, Rika. This was not what we intended.
Have a good night.
So, thank you so much again for listening. If you so desire to find us on social media, you can do so by locating me at... I don't know why I said that in such a complicated way. I kind of dug myself into a hole and then had to dig myself out again. I am at Weird Medieval on Twitter if you want Weird Medieval guys, or just at Olivia_MS if you want me.
I am at Aaron P. Tappers on Twitter and at Aaron on Blue Sky.
And I'm on the television.
Get off of our television! Get down!
You can't make me!
Roland, great spirit, look down on our sandals. Beckon us onward to victory.
Give me a David Attenborough thing to say.
Do David Attenborough narrating Skibidi Toilet.
This toilet, this may seem like an ordinary toilet, but look closer, and it's more than meets the eye.
And then it cuts to a close-up shot of a head very slowly and gently sort of coming out of the toilet, and the music goes, blink, 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 blink.
Yes.
This skibbity toilet must venture outside of the nest to find food for its children.
There you go. Is that enough?
Yeah, that was good. David Attenborough is quite good, actually. Thank you.